Welcome to Unsupervised Thinking, a podcast about neuroscience, artificial intelligence, and science more broadly. We're a group of PhD students studying computational neuroscience. I'm Grace.
I'm Josh.
And I'm Connor.
And the topic for this episode is transcranial direct current stimulation, which is also known as TDCS, but I, for some reason, always want to call it TSCD or TCDS, or just never the right ordering of the letters, so I'm probably going to do that throughout this. It is a form of neurostimulation, which is non-invasive, so you don't have to open the skull or anything, which obviously makes it appealing for studies in humans, and it's been used in a variety of studies. It's used for treatment of psychological diseases in certain ways, and it's been around for a while. So the basic idea of it is pretty simple.
Yeah, you run direct current through someone's head.
Basically, you put electrodes at the scalp in two locations, and you literally just run a small direct current through the people's head.
Yeah.
And so by calling this non-invasive, that's a little... I've actually heard, you know, some people have interesting definitions of what is non-invasive, and should we think of even, like, if you're administered a drug orally, you know, is that non-invasive? Well, of course, you've just taken a drug. The drug is literally interacting with your body. So in a sense, that's invasive. And I think it, like, according to like a certain definition, like the standard definition, this is non-invasive. But at the same time,
what would really be non-invasive if this is maybe invasive?
Well, prayer.
Yes, prayer is, well, so, I don't know the mechanisms of prayer, maybe.
I think, though, like, you could argue that some sort of imaging method, for example.
Oh, so observing rather than stimulating.
That is non-interactive. It doesn't cause changes.
Yeah.
Or it causes changes, I mean, obviously, you can't really observe in a technical sense without interacting with, but you're interacting with it like such a low level that, you know, for example, EEG is, you know, maybe authentically non-invasive insofar as it picks up currents that have been emanated through the skull. And so, yeah, technically it's interacting with the fields, but...
Okay, so because this is actually trying to perturb the system rather than just observe it, by some definition,
I think according to conventional definitions, this is considered considered non-invasive.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth keeping in mind that it is like directly interacting with
your
brain.
And the electrodes that you apply, there's a target electrode that goes over the region of the brain that you're interested in perturbing, and then there's a reference electrode that can go various other places that is just meant to complete the circuit.
But that doesn't make sense, right? Because there'll be effects at both.
The current flows from one of them to the other, and the directionality of the current is a free parameter that people choose. And so you can have kind of anode versus cathode at the target in the brain that you're interested in stimulating.
But sometimes people don't put it over a brain area as well, right? You can have one electrode over the brain, and then you can put the other electrode somewhere else on the head.
And it does seem to have an effect where you put the reference one, you might get different effects, even if the target electrode is in the same location. And they go...
Wouldn't it be better just in general to think of this as you put two electrodes somewhere on
So you're putting two electrodes and you can control the direction of the current, the strength of the current, and the duration that you stimulate. That's kind of the level of resolution we're talking about here.
And usually in the papers, people talk about stimulating one brain area,
which is like the target region.
Yeah, so in their parlance, there is a target and a reference, but yes, technically.
I'm kind of claiming that doesn't really make so much sense to me. Unless you were to put the other electrode on the chin or something.
But even then, you're directing the direction.
It's a very weird thing. You're putting these two electrodes somewhere on the head and you run some current through something.
A line goes kind of across them, but of course it follows like a path that isn't a line. And it kind of goes through some...
Because there's the conductivity of all the materials involved, the skull and the skin and all the other
tissues. So people do try to model that so that they can figure out what path it might take. But, you how closely we should believe those
some
models.
Complicated physics of head electrical conductivity, blah blah, will determine all of that.
And this, in this situation, the electrodes are touching the scalp versus in transcranial magnetic stimulation, which perhaps, if you see a picture of someone kind of holding a wand above someone's skull, that's magnetic, and this is directly touching the scalp, and it's the current stimulation. And when they apply them, I was reading about it, and they say, you know, you apply the electrode, and there's kind of like a sponge that touches the scalp to help the conductivity. And then when you look at pictures of it, like, it really is just like a big kitchen sponge in a lot of these. It's like a giant rectangular sponge at different parts on the scalp, which is kind of funny looking.
And the currents are weak, right? Like,
talking 1 milliamp.
Yeah, they said 2 is kind of the highest that would be recommended, but it's usually around 1.
What kind of, like, do you need, if I just take a battery and, like, stick it on?
You can use a battery.
Yeah,
there are claims that you need to regulate the, right, so there, you need to control how much current's coming out, so you need to build a circuit to regulate it, so it's strongly not recommended to do this at home, because if you don't build your regulator correctly, then the amount of current delivered to your brain could be larger than, like, the safe. Whatever,
so you're supposed to hook up a thing, and then it'll track the amount of current flowing in the circuit and regulate the voltage or something to match the right.
But there are definitely websites that will tell you how to do it with like a 9-volt battery or something like that. But not recommended that you do. But because it's this simple, it's been known that you could stimulate the brain this way for a while. I think the first experiments were in the 19th century is when they first started doing this. And even back then, so in 1801, they showed at least in one patient that it kind of lifted their melancholy, as they called it, which I guess we would call depression. But, so, yeah, it's a simple idea, and it's been around for a while, but kind of got a resurgence when neuroscience was becoming a concrete subject. So in the middle of the 20th century, that kind of time, it became more popular again and studied a lot.
And more recently then, there's been kind of, I guess, one of the papers that kind of rekindled in the, like, in the 80s was one that looked at motor-evoked potentials, right? So this is kind of the thing that you can study in the simplest case. So there's some combination of TMS and TDCS that can be used where, so like with TMS, you could just kind of ping a certain brain region for a brief pulse, if you want. And one thing that they look at are motor-evoked potentials, which basically mean muscle twitches somewhere in the body. So if you stimulate or I'll just use the term ping generically, you ping some brain region with TMS, so the magnetic stimulation, right, then you get some twitch somewhere if you stimulate some area in a motor cortex kind of region. And so it's, yeah, some twitch that was directly evoked. And the sort of strength of that motor evoked potential can apparently be modulated. This is the claim of some of these papers by TDCS. So if you use TDCS for a while, like a couple minutes on some area, it can change the excitability of that area. So and directionally, maybe even depending on whether there's cathodal or anodal targeting of the motor cortex region. So it's kind of the level that they're thinking about this at is that you kind of modulate the excitability of that cortical brain region so that the same strength ping with TMS, for example, changes the magnitude of the motor evoked potential.
Yeah, so we should talk about kind of the way that this like large-scale current running through the brain could change neural activity.
Yeah.
And so basically...
Sorry, one question first. We're talking usually about like minutes of this thing.
In these cases, you can stimulate with TMS, it's usually like brief pulses or sometimes longer. With this, it's usually seconds to sometimes minutes, and then the effects are there while the thing's on, but also can last for some amount of time afterwards. The reported effects, I should say.
Yeah, and so if you do. If you apply the current in a certain direction, then it's supposed to cause depolarization in the area of interest, and that means that the cells in the neurons in that area kind of are more excitable or more likely to have spikes or to have activity, which is obviously of interest if you want to stimulate a certain area to understand the role of that area in some task or something like that. And then if you apply the current in the opposite direction, it can perhaps make that area less excitable. So it's kind of silencing that area. And the exactly how true that is
for debate.
Yeah, it's debated.
But the sort of model is, right, this anodal excitation, cathodal inhibition model.
Yeah.
This is like a way of thinking about the effects of this at kind of a big scale level, kind of a bigger level than we, sort of non-experts in this field, people who tend to study kind of lower level neurobiological phenomena. This is kind of a high level.
Crude.
Yeah, from our standpoint, this is a very.
Yeah, the notion that you can just kind of turn up or turn down a whole area is a little confusing if you're used to thinking of an individual area as containing a lot of important structure and different cell types and that sort of thing.
Where, like, if excitatory and inhibitory cells are even mixed in a given brain
region.
So, like,
yeah,
if all those cells are modulated, then you're changing both excitation and inhibition somehow by changing. So it's slightly muddy in that sense.
It's extremely muddy, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but so you're saying, this thing here, what is it?
Anodal excitation, cathodal inhibition.
So if the anode is over some brain area,
it excites that. It increases excitability.
But the phenomenological definition of that excitability comes from these motor evoked potential studies originally?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's like a concrete phenomenological definition. Put the anode there, do your TDCS for a while, and then in this magnetic simulation paradigm, you'll see an increase in the twitch size, if you then take the same brain area. So that's the excitation.
Yeah.
The increase in the twitch to an unchanged stimulation. But in some of the papers then, when you hear the word excitation in neuroscience, you think of, or excitability, you think about single neuron excitability. So there's obviously this ridiculously huge gap between that concept and this excitation.
I think they're saying that it's supposed to increase the single neuron excitability of the whole region, which then it's not clear if that would be then accurate to say that that region is more excited, because if that region has a lot of inhibitory cells in it and you're exciting the inhibitory cells, the whole region could become more.
So it's also much more complicated than if there's excitability.
So there's clearly more to it than this. In one of the reviews which we've been looking at, we'll link, we've got there's a discussion of the fact that many neurotransmitters and kind of chemical messengers in the whole system are kind of regulated in various directions. So I think, yeah, from my standpoint, it seems like I almost want to just toss my hands up and say, this is extremely hard to figure out what precisely is going on. At a big level, there are ways that people in the field operationally want to think about what they're doing. I think the mechanisms are admittedly kind of not very well understood, even by people in the field.
In that review, which I'll just say the name of, is Neurobiological Effects of Transcranial Direct Current Stimulation, a review. I feel like even their takeaway was kind of we're going to throw our hands up. It was that everything is very complicated. It depends on the brain area. It depends on the types of cells in that brain area. It depends on all kinds of different things. And there isn't much hope for being able to tease it all apart anytime soon.
So, but functionally, the idea of these MEPs, these motor evoked potentials, I think that at least makes sense. I don't mean that it makes intuitive sense or you would know a priori what direction things would go, but that's at least an apparently quite visible phenomena, right? That maybe is true. I mean, there was some discussion as to whether you get actually anodal and cathodal effects in different papers have reported that it's maybe only unidirectional or if it's bidirectional. But so, I mean, at least in principle, that seems like an effect that you can measure. But I mean, beyond those kind of phenomenological effects, it's not even clear to me in principle we could figure out what this is. It seems like such a crude level tool. It's not like in the future of science, when we've studied it more, we'll figure out how it works. It's like, this is like a hammer to the brain in a certain sense.
I mean, it's really almost the most crude way of stimulating the brain you could think of, just run current
through
between two electrodes.
Yeah.
And the brain and the whole head is, you know, a big sack of, it's a big biological mass of tissue full of like salts and various compounds and chemicals of all kinds that are all functionally relevant. Neurons, the way they communicate is through electrical activity. So it's not surprising that it has effects.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the surprising thing would be if it had specific effects that
yeah.
are like reproducible and maybe even and, or useful
yeah.
for like studies
that
or
be,
medicine.
Would be, yeah.
So it would be like not necessarily what you would have expected and could be useful.
Agreed. So I think there are two things that it's worth maybe decomposing this into now and talking about. So one would be whether it's safe
yeah.
and whether we could show it was safe, if that's possible. Mm. And two is whether we can know what the effects are reliably and or leverage them for medical purposes. So let's maybe talk about the safety first. Briefly.
Or scientific purposes.
Or scientific purposes. So let's talk about the safety briefly. All three of us heard a talk at some point where we've seen this used or whatever, and it prompted us to, you know, naturally you might be curious because it seems like kind of an interesting tool, but also kind of a crazy tool. And I in particular was curious about the safety of this. And so when you start looking into it, it seems like there's characterization of when there's damage to the tissue. What kind of...
Well, there's the characterization of that I saw was in rodents.
Yes, yes.
Because you're
that's
not
okay.
going to intentionally
yes.
Damage human
that
tissue.
That was what I saw.
Yeah, and so I think they claim that the amount that is used in studies is two orders of magnitude less than what was shown to cause lesions in rodents.
Yes.
So they think they're very far from that threshold.
But this being said, so there's the issue of are you doing kind of visible tissue damage?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know...
Yeah, a lesion is a pretty strong
yeah.
thing to make happen.
So. Yeah,
so you're saying if you go two orders of magnitude higher current in a rat than is used in human studies... you will cause, like, cell death in the brain.
Yes.
On, like, a
notable,
scale visible
yeah.
under a microscope.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so, okay, but, so, I mean, I think what's clear is you are doing something. So, they, okay, and then they also know that there are long-lasting effects, for example, like on the calcium levels of the cells in these brain regions.
The long-lasting effects, that's the level
I mean intermediate.
Sure, sure, sure.
So, like, hours
yeah.
or days or something like this. And so, when I'm thinking about the safety... just to make this concern clear, I'm not thinking of tissue death. I mean, that would be a concern, but I think that's one that's obvious that we can avoid. I mean more, if you do this to someone for a day, are you going to, like, cause some sort of loss of ability or, like, some sort of amnesia of a certain sort or cause some weird kind of learning? I mean, on some level, right, in the most cautious or... irritatingly cautious way. Oh, like any stimulus that you see, like, oh,
it could affect you.
If you watch a Hollywood film and it's, you know, flashy and dull, it's going to mess with your mind because this is not the kind of concern. This is not the kind of concern I'm talking about here. Like, you're really.
It is, because it's this, in some way, it's a large scale thing to do to your brain and it's kind of distributed and there's just something about that combination that makes it seem like...
And we don't know what it is.
It's in some ways very directed because when you actually take in stimuli via your sense organs, like it's all going to different areas and areas that it was designed to go to and this is kind of just like passing this big river through your brain in ways that it wasn't necessarily designed to handle.
Yes. So but I will say maybe the same concern could arise for medicine and so we'll talk about some of the clinical stuff in a bit, but like just at least superficially, if you take some drug that is for some purpose or maybe recreation, but let's assume prescription drugs as well, right? You're taking some drug and it has some effect on you, even, you know, alcohol. It has some kind of major effect that your body isn't quite clear what to do with under natural circumstances. You could say, oh, it could have an effect. So, like, I think there would be people who kind of say, who their attitude might kind of calmly be, well, TDCS probably isn't doing something worse than alcohol if we use it kind of at safe levels. But I just don't know if, I mean, to me it seems like TDCS is extremely artificial and targeted towards your brain in a way where maybe it's for bad reasons, but it seems like it could at least be worse than like something like the effects of alcohol.
Yeah, well also, I mean, we can get into what's been shown that it can achieve. It doesn't seem nearly as fun as alcohol. So, you know, you're doing like a risk analysis. I don't know if it would be worth it.
Although you're supposed to be able to get hallucinations, right?
phosphenes, which are like just simple flashes of light, usually.
That's
what I've seen. Yeah. So, sorry, Connor. So there are side effects, which are these like flashes of light, maybe at the onset of it, and there could be skin irritation at the location where the electrode is, though there are ways to minimize that. Some people can get nauseous or headaches or get dizzy. So there are small side effects that could come from it, and more to the point is the sense that we don't know what happens if you apply this to yourself for many years or over. Even so, the normal course that would be suggested is do maybe 20 to 40 minutes of it every other day or every couple of
days.
This
is for what clinical
like
indications?
This is just the like across studies, that's kind of like the average treatment that's given when they're trying to...
When this ends up being a treatment or something.
Right? Yeah,
as a proposed treatment for some clinical thing.
And so if you do that for years, it's not known what the side effects are.
That's always the case with
treatments,
yeah. Right? So now we can maybe, this kind of segues nicely though into the whole kind of medical, we can get to the science stuff too later, but so that the medical idea would be, medical science in general kind of consists of a paradigm roughly as follows. There's something that people, for whatever reason, maybe historical fluke or some scientific accident or whatever, think might have some effect on some medical problem.
Or to be generous, because of like directed scientific research.
Sure, yeah. I mean, more recently that is sometimes true, right? But I mean, kind of in the history of medicine, you have some reason for maybe thinking,
accidental reason.
For thinking that something might be useful for some medical purpose. And then you try it for that medical purpose. Sometimes the mechanisms can be understood. So, like, there are kind of really cool cases where the mechanisms are understood. So, yeah. So, directed scientific research has been maybe useful in, like, HIV treatment or, you know, moderation of HIV. That's an example where people knew the structure of HIV and designed drugs to, a drug cocktail to target it. So, that kind of thing is maybe more exceptional, though, right? I mean, in the case that a lot of medical treatments arise from, you kind of have a hypothesis that something will be helpful, and without really looking too much at the mechanism, you do a kind of observational scientific experiment. Technically, it's not observational because you would actually apply it to a treatment in a control group. And so, in some sense, this is viewed as like science because you're kind of intervening and assessing the effect of this on the treatment group versus the control group. But it's done at a level of kind of abstraction that I would consider observational, which is just without understanding how the details of the treatment work, you just look for the effect that the treatment has. So the science is really just statistics applied to the effect that it has on a control versus treatment group. I think from, you know, a non-scientific perspective, that might seem like what much of science is, but a lot of science is targeted at finding kind of mechanistic understandings of how physical systems actually work. This is, yeah, purely descriptive. There is a phenomena, a behavioral change, a reported, you know, difference or a measurable difference in some kind of behavioral or psychological or, you know, physical disorder, and you're just kind of seeing if the thing that you think might have caused that has a significant effect size.
I mean, there's a whole philosophy about what it means. What's the difference between observational understanding versus like mechanistic understanding?
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And I think in this case, it's a spectrum. I mean, there's people, yeah, who would be considered more basic scientists who don't even have a therapeutic goal in mind. They just want to understand something about the body or the brain, and they're just working on that. And so they have models of how they think it works, and they come up with experiments to test out those models or falsify them. And, you know, they gain information that way and they can refine their model. I don't think that clinical researchers who are doing this kind of course, like intervention and observation, but on this course level, I don't think that they're of a completely different breed. I think their models are just much, much simpler. They kind of think this brain area I know is involved in emotion, so if I zap it, maybe emotion will get better in this patient, something like that. So there, it's still following something of the same model, it's just much coarser. And so it's hard to equate these things. You know, I can't really look at a study that uses TDCS and get a lot out of it that would be useful for me and my interests in understanding something on a smaller scale, but I still think it's just part of this continuum.
Yeah, so I mean, this kind of gets into a discussion about what scientific mechanism means, and I think we have kind of maybe slightly different opinions, though probably the three of us might have a bit more consensus on this topic relative to other people because we study science at a similar level. I kind of tend towards a sort of stricter thinking where if you can't tie the proposed kind of mechanism to actual physical processes in a concrete way, then I'm disinclined to even think of it as appropriately termed mechanism. To me, mechanism needs to be kind of clearly connected to the physics of the system. And I think that is a kind of a hard, maybe a relatively hard line stance on what mechanism means. But I think without that, the level of descriptions that you can have, it's not clear to me if they're informative or falsifiable or comparable, other than at a kind of very disconnected and abstract level. I mean, clearly you can still do things with it, right? You could say, does zapping this brain region causally, you know, mechanistically change the behavior? But somehow being divorced from concrete physical processes, it's not clear to me you're gaining scientific insight. You're gaining some sort of engineering style insight, which again can be very useful for clinical applications, but it's hard to know if it's useful from the standpoint of building deeper scientific understanding off of.
It's an interesting question. That's a whole tangent that you could go off on for hours, but it's an interesting thing because then it gets up like, why do we do science at all? And from a non-scientific point of view, it might seem like a lot of the purpose of science is to, as quickly as possible, improve people's lives or something. And so then it becomes less clear why you care about this strict idea of scientific understanding.
So in terms of safety, I think it's very hard to know whether it would be safe because it's not clear, at least in the short term, that we could even, I mean, if there's a concern as to if this does things that are potentially damaging on long time scales, one, we'd have to record for long time, or we have to stimulate for long time scales and keep data about the kind of effects on a lot of things. And it's going to be hard because these could be subtle things. Maybe people have, you know, there'll be, you know, improvements in some domains, especially if the person's being treated for like depression or something. There'll be maybe minor deficits in other domains. I mean, this just gets at kind of all of the details of medical science in general, which is you have to kind of do observational work on relatively long time scales and then look for kind of effects in the data. This is kind of the standard epidemiological research.
Yeah, I actually don't know much about how this works. So, I mean, in pharmacology nowadays, people try to develop drugs for different diseases and stuff. Like, is it right? I mean, usually there's academic scientists who work with animals. So they have, like, animal models of something they want to say depression. You have some animal model of depression.
Which means, like, a mouse that is manipulated in some way, perhaps genetically, so that it kind of
seems
depressed like behavior.
Usually, it
means that it stops swimming when you put it in water. That's a very common test of depression in mice.
Right. Yeah. So okay, fine. So that's the whole thing. It's like, what does it mean for a mouse to be depressed? And like, in the sense of like, what does it mean for this to be a good animal model of depression in human beings? When obviously mice and human beings are very different. But let's just say we have an animal model of like depression, and we kind of decide, yes, this mouse is depressed. And if we can treat this mouse's depression, it might tell us something about how we can treat human depression. So people will study the thing. They'll have maybe hypotheses, or they'll do exploratory stuff. They'll do genetic manipulations. They'll give it drugs or do other kinds of treatments. They could do TDCS on it if they wanted to. And then they'll come up with some intervention.
They can propose for humans or something.
Yeah. So, and they'll say, oh, this has an effect. And then they'll... So I think it might be helpful just because we're talking about TDCS as used in some medical situations to kind of quickly go through our basic understanding of how medical trials, sort of the testing of new proposed therapies works in general, because this is very standardized and well-defined.
Sure.
And you can look it up on Wikipedia.
Yeah. So, like, Wikipedia has an article on phases of clinical research, where we're basically, you know, pulling this information from. Basically, you know, you'd start with preclinical trials where in non-human subjects, like animals, rodents, you're just checking kind of how long the drug lasts and if it's toxic and kind of vaguely what it does. And this could be academic or it could be done in a kind of company-based setting. And then there are the early phases, like phase zero and phase one, are small numbers of people who are given small doses, and it's more just kind of to get a sense of, even in healthy people, you know, if the drug is safe in quantities that would start having effects. Phase two and phase three move into people testing the drug on patients to assess both whether the drug is doing anything and to continue to ensure that it's safe. So monitoring it for side effects and things like this. And then what's called, I guess, phase four is after the drug has gone out and is in public use, you have to kind of make sure you're observationally monitoring the effects of the drug to ensure that as you get bigger data sets now, because now instead of just a couple hundred people trying it, you might have thousands or millions of people who have taken some drug, you can verify that there aren't new effects that you missed when you were doing all the stuff before it went out. So, I mean, the same kind of this kind of pipeline is for clinical trials and clinical research in general. People think of it mostly as applied to drugs, but the same kind of thing would apply if you wanted to use TDCS for depression or some other kind of psychological illness that you know, where people would try this kind of on a daily basis or something like that.
For this kind of thing in research, like if you want to do something to a person in like a lab in a study, you just have to have like approval from the ethics board of the university, right?
Yeah, so often if it's a drug, so there are details. It can be, unless you're a medical doctor, I think it's very hard to sometimes use things that haven't been approved for something. But once a drug or a treatment or a device or whatever has been approved for something by the FDA, people can use it kind of off-label according to some level of regulational oversight.
So I don't think TDCS has been approved by the FDA.
Okay. So I think TDCS, so I don't know the extent to which TDCS is being used actually, like, by the public for any clinical things. So aside from all of these kind of medical things, for academic research involving humans as subjects or patients, that's often even just non-clinical stuff, you need to verify that, you know, what you're going to do is safe.
An internal review
board. It's an internal review board for universities. And it's the regulation here is slightly complicated because if you're not associated with the university, there's different regulational oversight. But generally, yeah, people in academia who want to do even kind of, you know, non-clinical research need to, if they're going to involve human patients or human subjects, I should say, they need to show that what they're going to be doing is safe enough that they can do it.
Yeah, so both TMS and TDCS are not FDA approved for treatment of clinical problems, even though they are being studied for that in certain research settings. But you could still go to a center that does this kind of simulation and get it done to treat yourself for a disease. It's just, you have to sign something, I think, that acknowledges that you know that this is an off-label, not approved procedure.
Yeah, that's kind of strange. I mean, I don't know when it's decided, like, when it's decided whether something is legally permissible for someone to offer as a service to someone. It seems like it's fairly broad. Like, you can do a lot of things, especially if it's termed non-invasive.
So I should clarify, TMS apparently has been approved for depression in individuals who do not respond to prior treatment.
Well, that makes it then. So you can,
yeah, but not TDCS.
Okay.
TMS has been approved.
Yeah, there's a lot of off-label usage rules.
Yeah.
Right, so.
Yeah.
A lot of the point of this kind of digression is about just to kind of point out the fact that to really understand if it is safe, you would need to kind of do, well, it's not clear exactly what you would need to do, but you would at least need to do a lot of observational studying of people using it, probably over, you know, potentially over long time scales, because we don't know what time scale it might have effects on. But kind of this is a digression to point out, like, this is sort of always the case with any intervention in humans of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
There's always some inherent risk. There are all these protocols designed to make it, you know, to minimize risk. But some of your concern is...
It's tied to, I mean, even still, tying this to this discussion on mechanism as well, I'm kind of always a bit concerned when the level of the science is, hey, let's see what the effect of this thing is, and the best you're going to expect in terms of seeing whether it's safe or whether it has some efficacy is just kind of observing people and checking for problems, like kind of spot checking for problems. Like,
yeah, if you have a decent understanding of what you think the mechanism is in more than some very coarse level way, then you know what kind of side effects to look for. You're better suited to check for potential side effects if you understand the system that you're modulating. Whereas if you're just going in and trying something and see if it makes the thing that you want to go away, like you tried to cure depression, but then since you don't know why the thing you did cured the depression, you have no idea what other pathways to check regarding it.
And clinical, does seem to me that from conversations I've had, people who do clinical research tend to be comfortable with different level of resolution. I wouldn't even necessarily view it as abstraction. I mean, there's in the scope of science, maybe physicists and mathematicians are the most comfortable with abstraction, where you're kind of coming up with ideas that generalize across many settings. This is really a low level of resolution, where you're just kind of you have some model, kind of in quotes, that is very coarse, very macroscopic. It's not clear exactly how it ties to things, but you can kind of use it a bit. It works enough for you to make kind of very coarse level hypotheses about what to change in terms of like your stimulation protocol or something like this to maybe get effects with some level of reliability. This whole kind of science, it's not totally comfortable for me.
Well, it stems from the desire to actually have something that functions more than nothing. So you have to settle for a non-preferred level of resolution just so you can make any progress in the real world.
Sure, yeah.
If we waited until we understood the role of every neuron in the brain, we'd never be able to help anyone with anything.
But that's, I think there are intermediate levels where... I guess all I'm trying to say is,
Josh is a very cautious person. Yeah. There's a lot of fear.
I'm not sure if I would go that far.
Would you ever try TDCS, Josh?
I'd be very disinclined to try TDCS.
Okay.
But again, because even different than I'll take an Advil or whatever.
Josh will take oral things that are stronger than Advil. So it's kind of interesting, your standards around safety. It makes me think that,
it could be totally unfounded.
Yeah, but maybe there's also something to it. I don't know, given that you're not like a hypochondriac or something, as far as I can tell.
I'm mostly not a hypochondriac.
Yeah.
But the idea of a treatment where you're not exactly sure what it's doing and you kind of are pretty sure you'll never know exactly what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. And to me, there is also something about the fact that it goes directly onto your scalp and through your brain.
It is very 19th century.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah. Hook yourself up and shock yourself.
It's kind of a Frankensteinian feeling.
Yeah.
Thing, like that.
The idea that if I take a drug, I have some not founded faith that my digestive system and everything will process it in the right way and it won't have the wrong effects. No, it's obviously ridiculous, but at least I can tell myself that, whereas putting electrodes on my head, the best I can say is my scalp will protect me from the bad.
Yeah,
well,
the balance of
buffering.
Excitation and inhibition. I don't know. Maybe there's feedback.
An anecdote that I have is I went to a hackerspace in Manhattan, and there was a guy there who was just experimenting with TDCS on himself, kind of casually with a home-built TDCS machine. And I think people are at least some people, I'm not going to overestimate the numbers. I think people like to overestimate the numbers on this. There are a few people in this country, more than no one.
probably in like hacker spaces or people who have talked to such people.
Well, there
are
companies, there are startups that sell this.
No, yeah, no.
Directly.
So this is clear too. Yeah, what's the name of this product?
Focus.
Well,
FOC.us. So I don't know how I'm supposed to pronounce it.
Okay.
Focus. I don't know.
But so okay, there are products. There are people. I mean, certainly people on hacker spaces who have built home-built ones, which seems less safe to me. Yeah. You know, products that are going in this direction, and you know, it's an interesting thing to me that people are. I mean, it's about different levels of perceived risk and different levels of kind of caution. People like to be those who explore kind of new opportunities, but to me,
yeah, we like those people, right? As a society,
yeah.
we laud the
yeah, I mean,
adventurers.
But if they're doing all this adventuring without taking careful notes and doing controlled studies, I don't know what we gain from it.
It's like Columbus setting out across the ocean.
Like, who cares if you know, you know, where the rivers are?
He brought cartographers, right? I mean, like, I think that's a fair analogy, though, right?
Like, so, like, there were probably like loads of really crazy guys who didn't take precautions and like died at sea when around the same era as Columbus, and he was the one who
had cartographers.
So you're saying if you're going to apply TDCS to yourself, at least take good notes and.
Or at least have someone standing
next to you.
Someone
standing
next
to you, turn it all.
Yeah. I mean, and I wouldn't encourage necessarily.
Oh, yeah, well, we shouldn't endorse.
But more than just like, I don't even mean that in like the funny
sense.
Yeah, like, oh, we're not going to take responsibility.
No, you just honestly don't think it has a big enough effect that they should.
It's not clear to me that you could target things precisely enough for it to be both interesting and also, I mean, there's some risk involved, and like kind of just given what I know about the brain, I'm somewhat skeptical that you can get it to do very interesting things with high effect size reliably, you know.
So yeah. I will say for the startup-based ones, this is from Focus's website, and not to single them out, but I'm definitely singling them out, because on their website they claim that this device will help you overclock your brain and make your synapses fire faster.
So it sounds like limitless, you know.
Well, it sounds like someone who's never read
so
a neuroscience
ridiculous.
Textbook, which is not who I want to buy
a neuroscience
device from.
I mean, well, we shouldn't, you know, without focusing on any specific companies, there's a sense in which, I mean, I think we kind of have a feeling that there are people who come up, like, get a PhD and are not sure what to do with it, and then go, like, endorse, you know, or participate in the creation of neuro products, that it's not exactly clear if they're well principled or well grounded. But there's money out there for people who want to claim such things.
So we should talk about what the actual
science.
Yeah, peer reviewed science says about what this technology is capable of doing. So yeah, we talked about the initial studies on the motor system that seem decently well-founded and show proper effects of how applying this can change kind of how excitable the motor system is or how responsive it is to then applying magnetic stimulation. So, and that's where this idea of the anodal excited and cathodal inhibition really came from. But we read this other review paper, which is called TDCS Polarity Effects in Motor and Cognitive Domains, a Meta-Analytical Review. And that just made an interesting point, I think, that showed that this notion that you can control whether you're kind of turning an area up or down based on the direction of the current doesn't seem to hold quite as well in cognitive areas, that those findings came mostly from the motor areas. And then when you apply TDCS to more cognitive areas, and try to measure, you know, effects on cognitive tasks and that sort of thing, there's not such a clear kind of effect or directional effect. And so it's usually the case that the anodal activation may give you excitability and cathodal may give you nothing or something.
What's
like
that mean? What's excitability in a cognitive
It means it's like improvement maybe on the cognitive task,
changes.
I don't think, versus, you know, worsen performance on the cognitive task. So, I mean, I think people, again, there's kind of a crude level model where people are thinking like, oh,
brain
kind of stimulates this brain
up
or
down.
Yeah.
Like this brain area does making you good at chess So if you turn it on more, you'll be better at chess. That kind of thing.
If you turn it down, it'll be worse at chess.
Worse at chess.
And, or even more simply, working memory or, you know.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, I find this is like such a ridiculous
well, that's
way
like,
of
I mean, yeah, this is very foreign to the way we think about neuroscience.
But it is. It's in
it's
line with the very standard kind of old school psychology approach. But even modern psychology doesn't really think of things in terms of individual brain areas.
Yeah.
Brain areas by themselves having specific effects. So, yeah. The best, I guess the way you would interpret these studies in modern psychology is that it's, you know, changing the networks in some way.
Again, I mean, I think the thing that we should be clear about is different fields have different languages and different, like, latent assumptions. It's not the case, I believe, that these people are, like, you know, I think the generous interpretation of this is that they kind of have these operational definitions.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right, right. Like, there's a brain region that they think is responsible for something approximately. It's not like they know that that's already an abstraction. And then this has only two, like, there's only two directions to this. So the only natural way to think about it is that it upregulates or downregulates that brain region and thereby upregulates or downregulates performance on something that you can otherwise observe, like behavior or motor or potential or something like this.
I mean, like, doing neuroscience is very uncomfortable all the time because you kind of always, you know, it's like so complicated and people know kind of so little, but also kind of know a lot of specific things, and it's very hard to put all those together in any coherent way.
Yeah.
And you want to kind of understand things a lot, and you have to aggressively simplify, but then you know as you're aggressively simplifying that you're throwing away so much, and maybe what you're throwing away is kind of everything you're interested in, but you never can really know. And so it's very uncomfortable in some way, if you're, especially if you're in any way kind of neurotic or like a little bit obsessive, then it's an extremely unpleasant activity to engage in.
Are you okay, Connor? And if you have any interest in behaviors that are uniquely human, you're kind of, you know, heavily constrained in the types of studies that you can do because you can't do the manipulations that you can do in an animal. And so if you want to think about anything that you think is specific to humans and you want to be able to still manipulate the system in some way, you're kind of limited to these coarse applications.
But so what were, are there any other cognitive tasks that we wanted to talk about?
So one of the things that I saw was if you stimulate the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is kind of in the front of the brain, and the prefrontal cortex generally is associated with decision-making and executive action and planning and all kinds of things that, you know, we think are important to us as humans as we live our life.
Everything. It's prefrontal cortex is associated with everything.
Well, everything that's non-sensory.
But also,
even then.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
you
okay,
integrate
but
sensory stuff and what. So, yeah, so if you activate that area, it seems that
this very big general area.
Well, dorsolateral
yeah. okay.
prefrontal cortex.
Which is, it's quite, that's actually quite large.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, we have heard certain well-known people, neuroscientists, who will go unnamed in a, with a tone of slight irritation, maybe, refer to, talk about papers where they say things like prefrontal cortex as being kind of analogous to writing a paper about some particular part of visual cortex and referring to it as sensory cortex or something like that. So it's kind of,
they're broad, broadly
broad.
Defined areas.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so that in this kind of set of papers, it's equating or demonstrating the ability of altering this area to have an effect on riskiness in decision making. So they have like a simplified task where participants are making decisions, and, you know, obviously you can vary how risky things are. People will try to make a risky decision for the hope of a big reward, or if they'll go with more steady rewards over time or something. And they say that this stimulating this area can make people engage in riskier behavior. And doing the opposite with the TDCS can have effects in the opposite direction. So this is one example where there might be evidence.
TCDS. We keep calling it TDCS.
I told you. It's TDCS.
Transcranial direct.
No, transcranial is one word. That's
I know.
Yeah.
So it's not TCDCS.
Exactly. But it should be. Because I feel like transcranial is two words.
So we're right. It's TDCS.
It's TDCS.
Yeah.
But I also sometimes want to say TCDS.
Or TCDCS.
So TCDS in DLPFC.
You said it wrong, too.
No.
Okay. Anyway, back to the point.
Right. This is an example of a cognitive effect. An effect on riskiness in decision-making or risk-taking. That would be one example.
And so, the natural questions that arise when you hear that, oh, there's some effect on risk-taking when we stimulate is how strong do you have to stimulate and what's the magnitude of the effect? And so the stimulation that they can do is within the safe range. So that's not a super relevant question because they're going to be stimulating kind of as strongly as they feel is safe, probably. But then the magnitude of the behavioral effect in this case is like how much riskier do they get when they stimulate?
So like, I just want to what are the possible outcomes of such an experiment, right? You pick a behavioral task. You have an intervention which you're going to apply in some kind of localized way, localized in terms of where in the brain it's applied, and you choose to apply it to a big chunk, a piece of the brain which is known to be involved in like a whole plethora of cognitive functions, right? So you have your behavioral task, and you're going to intervene in some way in this area, in this case with this stimulation. Like the possible outcomes are there's no effect, or there's like one of... Usually the tasks are designed.
Usually the tasks are designed such that it can basically a binary.
You can go up or down or whatever. Like in this case, risk. You can be more risk seeking or less risk seeking, or there can be no effect. So it doesn't. Like, I mean, because you could claim, oh, this means that the prefrontal cortex is like involved in risk assessment or something like this. Like
evaluative or something. Mm-hmm.
But if you think about like the possible outcomes, it's really
it's
not.
Assuming it modulates your brain in a meaningful way at all, it should potentially modulate the task if the brain region is at all task relevant, though. I mean,
So what it tells you things like, so one thing it tells you is like, which we mentioned at the very beginning, it's not obvious that it has to do anything. It's not obvious that this stimulation has to do anything to the brain. People kind of knew that then from these early motor studies. Okay, so now it kind of turns out in some behavioral tasks, it also seems to do something.
Yeah.
And then it tells you the second thing that you were saying is that the brain area is in some way involved. So presumably if you did this in like...
Visual cortex
or something like that.
Unless it makes it so that
you can't see
the task.
Yeah, but
so,
controlling for that.
Yeah.
Okay, but
So it's hard to, in this kind of thing, it's hard to say exactly what aspect of this whole decision-making process it's really... affecting.
But a thing, I'm not trying to make this sound trivial, right? Like, because one of the things, which I think is a valid point, that sometimes the authors of these papers will kind of allude or will refer to directly is, how do people usually assess the involvement of brain areas in different tasks nowadays, or in different processes and so on, cognitive processes, brain processes in general. Nowadays, one of the standard things to do is to do functional brain imaging, like to do fMRI, and so that's kind of, you're measuring blood flow changes, and that's a common way to say, oh, this area is involved in these kinds of tasks, and this other area is involved in these other kinds of tasks. So one strength of this simulation that people often refer to in these papers is that this is not mere, that is in some sense correlative, this fMRI. You do something and you look at changes that correlate with doing the task or how you do the task or whatever.
So like a brain region becomes some proxy for the activity in that brain region. Is up-modulated or down-modulated when you're doing some tasks. So that kind of implies that something about that brain region is
involved
in the task.
And so the idea here is that this is an interventional thing, so you're supposed to be able to more kind of get at causation somehow.
Like I think it follows pretty directly from seeing an fMRI study that shows that dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex is modulated during assessing risk. You know, if you see that study and then you think, well, what brain area should I target if I want to change risk-seeking behavior? It seems like, that you would come in with this kind of approach.
But
the usefulness of these approaches does depend on a thing we referred to earlier, which is like how modular is the brain, which is an ongoing discussion in neuroscience, right?
Yeah.
If the brain was completely not modular, then stimulating any part of the brain should have some effect on every task.
Yeah.
Right? So if the brain is highly modular, then these kind of stimulating interventions can be very informative because you stimulate very locally and you can help to localize the brain. So I mean,
or at least, identify that the brain region is part of some
cell. As we pointed out, this is not a hyper-localized perturbation.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. And it's pretty kind of fuzzy in terms of its mechanistic detail, right? We just know that some brain region is implicated at all.
Although I did see that there's like a new form of this that's high definition TDCS, which uses multiple electrodes, I guess, to kind of target things more specifically. I'm not sure how it works.
I'd be almost more interested to see studies that like tried this, took a task or a battery of tasks, did the stimulation in like in some kind of grid with a reference electrode, say somewhere on the chin or something. I don't know if that's considered a decent protocol, but say on the chin, and then just move the other electrode across like a grid on the brain, and then like do some differential comparison. You can say
on a behavioral test,
yeah, or something
like use the same behavioral test and just see how specific the
localization. I mean, that seems, I would be interested.
I think getting all the data from many brain regions for the same task and multiple tasks starts getting combinatorial.
We'll just say one task and one electrode at a time in different places.
These studies tend to have low numbers of participants, or I mean, it depends on what you're comparing it to. But I think it's not trivial to get people to sign up for these things.
Yeah.
So, Grace, what was the effect size in these risk studies?
So they measure it in terms of the percent of kind of the number of times that the person chooses the low risk choice in this task setup. And I guess when they're doing sham stimulation, which means they have the electrodes on the person's brain, but they're not actually stimulating, so it's supposed to control for a placebo effect, they choose the low risk option in 87% of trials. And then when they do the stimulation, they choose the low risk option in around 80% of trials.
Which presumably is significant, but there's some level of uncertainty.
Sure.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I think this does kind of implicate things, but it also, it's even harder to assess when you're not sure about the magnitude. I mean,
and this is just one study. I mean, obviously, there's whole distributions of effect sizes and study sizes and all kinds of
things. I just mean, for the purposes of people who get, really excited about scientific effects, when reported by the media, like a sensationalistic article about this would say something like, oh, risk behavior totally modulated by the brain, but it's like, or by simulation of some brain area. But of course, the scientific effect that scientists would see as a huge effect is like a few percentage points, because it's meant just minimally, not for like kind of useful purposes, but just kind of minimally to demonstrate the importance of that brain area, right? The kind of, it's not of a kind of magnitude that's likely useful for like, a
curing,
casino to manipulate
curing
its
addiction,
causing addiction. Like, casino is going to modulate the people in the casino's behavior by giving them some TDCS remotely.
It is. There was some study I saw that was about the effects on gamblers, but I can't find it now. I also saw an effect that said that it increases reaction time in some working memory search task, which also seems like a negative thing. You don't usually want to be slower at tasks.
Yeah, which is also gives you the concern that,
well, unless you get more accurate.
Sure. Yeah, but I think a lot of these things always raise in my mind, if you can't demonstrate positive effects with this, it could be just like, you're kind of interfering with the brain, and so it's like, we kind of interrupted the brain processing a bit, and there's a deficit. It's a minor deficit because we only interrupted the brain a little bit.
Yeah, but if it's a double negative, it can be good. Right? Like, if you want to cause a deficit in addictive behavior.
Yeah, there was one that said that that claimed that they could decrease cravings in people who use marijuana.
Yeah, and there's a whole line of research on kind of savant-like abilities, which it's along the same lines. The idea is that there's the claim in that literature is that there are brain regions that kind of impose from a top-down way like structure on the world. And so some kind of savant-like abilities could be improved by sort of trusting sensory inputs more than you might normally trust them, because you otherwise come to the world imposing your own structure and biases on it. So by interfering with those kind of top-down signals, you can, do things like have better numerosity.
There's also, we've been talking about the cognitive effects, but the more perhaps clinically interesting effects are that, as we've said, they talked about using it for treating of depression or pain or Parkinson's disease, that kind of stuff. So those, the pain and Parkinson's disease and things that have kind of more direct relation to either motor output or sensory input maybe have stronger grounding in kind of believing that this stimulation could have big effects there, just because it's in some way simpler if you're just trying to gate what's going in or out versus trying to modulate the complicated cognitive processes.
And I guess we know more about like where sensory processing happens, or we claim to.
So yeah, it's TDCS is a old approach, and it's pretty simple. And as you may expect, because of its simplicity, it's got kind of coarse effects that are difficult to fully characterize. And so it can offer some benefits for the study of the brain and maybe even for treatment of certain things. But it's complicated, and as Josh said, we'll probably never fully understand it.
But I guess it is pretty cool, given its coarseness, that it has all these effects at all. Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm still concerned about safety.
Josh is worried about it.
Okay. Till next time.